Council, you may approach the council table, and while you're getting set up, I'll just make a few announcements. This is our final case on the calendar, A230644, Metropolitan Transit Network, Inc. et al. Versus Collaborative Student Transportation of Minnesota et al. Council, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Please state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. Let us know if there's any particular way we can reference you this morning. These matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted. Counsel for appellants, I understand that you are splitting your time. Mr. Ward, I believe you're using 6 minutes, and Ms. Ward, I believe you are using 9 minutes.
That is correct.
Okay, very good. And whenever you are ready, we are ready for you.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Latessa Ward, and I am one of the attorneys representing the appellants in this case, the plaintiffs below, and that is Metropolitan Transportation Network and Safetree Transportation. Today we request that this court reverse summary judgment that was granted to the defendants in this case. With respect to counts two, plaintiff's breach of illusory contract claim, count three, plaintiff's breach of good faith and fair dealing claim, count six, the plaintiff's interference with contracts claim, count seven, interference with contracts, prospective business advantages claim, and count 13, a violation of Minnesota Statute 325D.53. I'm going to be addressing counts 3, 6, and 7. First, plaintiff's claims should rise or fall on the merits. The jury should decide which side prevails in this case, not the court below. Second, while defendants and the district court assert that plaintiff's brief failed to identify specific, particular pinpoint citations to the record, that simply is not true. There were some blanks here and there, particularly in the argument section. But if this court would look at both Index 47 and Index 56, which are the plaintiff's oppositions to the briefs, and look at the facts section, the court will note that with respect to each, practically each sentence or groups of sentences, there are specific citations to the record, either the deposition testimony, the affidavits that were filed in the case, and in the facts section, there are a few instances where there were blanks, where we didn't go back and fill in the blanks. But that's a very few instances. I think I looked at about three in that section. In the argument section, there's more citations to the facts section, supra, that kind of thing. And then there are some clear blanks with it that should have been filled in. But that is not dispositive. I think that rule, I believe it's rule 115, requires that the parties specify the facts and cite to places in the record where those facts can be supported. And that was done in the facts section. In addition, in the facts section, counsel specifically, when describing conduct and describing it as a fact or an allegation, talked about what that conduct meant. For example, the conduct was described as a non-compete or a non-solicitation clause that prevented Safetree from soliciting certain businesses, which are public entities, by the way, and that was described as a restraint of trade. in the fact section.
Can I just ask, Council, as a point of clarification in the record, is it factually correct that SafeTree, notwithstanding the non-solicitation clause, did in fact contract with other school districts? I think it was Robbinsdale, maybe some others. Is that factually accurate?
It is actually accurate, and I believe that Mr. Ward will address that more fully, but I will point out, Your Honor, that SafeTree's owner testified that he refrained from bidding on several contracts. That is in the record, and it is in the record with references to the made by the not only the plaintiffs but also defendants.
And where specifically in the record? I just want to make a note of that to go.
Okay, I would find that and let the court know.
Okay, on rebuttal is fine.
I do have it written down, but I believe that what Mr. Wake specifically testified to was that he did not bid on the Osseo school district and some other school districts, and that is actually in our.
Are you talking about the declaration, Wake? His declaration.
His deposition. In his deposition.
Okay.
I would like to comment very quickly about that deposition. Mr. Wake is not a U.S., he was not born here. English is not his first language. I was not at his deposition, but I read the transcript. And if you read that transcript, you will clearly understand that he was struggling with understanding the questions. And many times, in many instances, specifically, he said, I don't really understand. I'm not a lawyer. And I already told you that. So what the defense counsel did in its motions was to take the times where he said, I've already told you that, or I don't remember, or some subsequent question. As we know, lawyers ask a question, they don't like the answer, they ask it later, and they ask it in a different way. They try to get a different answer. But in reality, the defense did not exercise candor toward the court, because the defendants knew exactly that Mr. Wake had given, I think, four or five districts that he refrained from bidding for. And that is in the record as well. So the notion that there was not references or specific citations to the record by paragraph numbers in affidavits or deposition pages is just simply not true.
But I just want to interrupt you. I thought I heard you say you were going to address the declaration itself, which it does not appear was filed in the district court record, but is, you know, has been submitted to this court. Is it your position that that is appropriately before us?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And on what authority?
Well, there was no authority to say that it could not, because it wasn't literally filed in that case, that it could not be referenced or relied on. I believe the record, again, this, I was not involved in the case at the time, but the parties had an agreement that they would, because there are three cases that are associated and related, that they would address the discovery, as it will, in different things, and they would use them in all of the cases. That's number one. Number
was what? Where was that agreement reached?
There, I believe it's a footnote. It was reached in. It was either reached in this case or in another case. But there is a footnote in our brief that specifically.
But that's what we struggle with. Is in your memorandum of law, you talk about the Wake, the declaration and the attached exhibits. But you're only referencing them in the context of your argument, and they're not a part of the record that's before us, but for the after-the-fact filing. So I don't know that this is the record that the trial court relied on.
The trial court actually talked about what was in that recording and what was in that affidavit. And the judge actually said that when the court reviewed the affidavit, she did not see A, B, and C. She did not see any specific factual statements that related to it. In addition, the audio tape and the reference to the declaration itself was raised by CISO in its opening brief. And we talk about that in our reply brief as well. But it was raised by CISO in its opening brief. And all of the parties talked about it, including during oral argument. I see that my time is up.
Your time has expired, Ms. Ward. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank
you. And we'll hear from Mr. Ward now. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. As my co-counsel stated, I will be addressing counts two, the breach of contract and the enforceability, the attempt to enforce the potential illusory contract, as well as section 325D.53.
Can I ask a question about count two? The way that I normally think about, and I think courts normally think about an illusory contract is as a defense in a breach of contract action. It's not supported by adequate consideration. There's a promise that is hollow and or could be easily backed out of without any justification. I didn't see in the briefing from either party or in my own research any authority that indicates that breach of an illusory contract is an independent affirmative cause of action. What is the best case that you can point us to that would stand for that proposition?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I did cite to it in the briefing. I apologize for not having it right up in front. But it's State v. Alpine, as well as State v. State by Humphrey versus Alpine Air Products, 490 Northwest 2nd, 888. And, sorry, Your Honor, that's with regard to 325D.
Okay.
It's Whitestone Partners versus Piper Jaffray, 978 F Sup 878, District of Minnesota, 1997. And Recap Liquidating Trust versus Primary Residential Mortgage, Inc., 428 F Sup 3rd, 53, District of Minnesota, 2019. And both of those cases, both of those cases address the affirmative claims of a party that they're able to bring. As stated in the brief and partially recognized by the district court, There's two alternative means in which to address the type of contract that we have here, where there was one, agreements or promises to provide, but no obligation to provide unless it's within the discretion of one party.
And that's the assignment of routes, right?
Pardon me?
And the assignment of bus routes.
That's the assignment of bus routes. The assignment, the reduction, the increase, those items in the contract that were spoken of. The other alternative is the enforceability, the opportunity for a party to enforce what may be, and what the cases call it is potential illusory contract by using the doctrine of good faith and fair dealing, and that's how it was raised. They're essentially the two sides of the same coin, as it was argued. Where you have a situation where you have these terms and the fulfillment of an express term or the terms that we spoke about, the assignment of routes reduction, reposes in one party, you can bring a breach in a circumstance where the party doesn't act appropriately or withholds the discretion to assign the routes, to reduce or do whatever, you can bring a breach of that. Again, as both of the cases say, under the theory of implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, where they're not acting appropriately when they withhold their discretion. The flip side of that, the alternative, is when you have a situation that, again, the discretion, 100% discretion, is reposed in one party. What you do is you can seek to enforce the term if that party doesn't use honesty and good faith in that withholding of the discretion. And so what the courts have said, those two cases that I've cited, as well as a federal case that I've cited in the brief, what they say is, in those circumstances, what you're trying to do is avoid the application of having it be seen as an illusory contract. But if the parties, if the party in which the discretion is reposed breaches the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, then it becomes an illusory contract. And so those matters weren't appropriately addressed at the district court on the premise that there were no facts to support it. And again, as Ms. Ward stated when she was up here, in our facts section, not only do we talk about these specific pinpoint citations, we also refer INFRA back to them in the verified complaint. And again, while there may have been a few instances where it says on information and belief, one, that doesn't undermine the ability of the allegations in the complaint to be considered as appropriate evidence on the record, where the party who's making the statement not only verifies it, but they're the party in a position who has personal knowledge of it and is in a position to understand and know and approve, or they are in a position of knowing that information, but they can't swear to it because they didn't create it. For example, they can say on information and belief that something is true because their expert witness has stated. I see my time is up.
Your time has expired, Mr. Ward.
I would like to say I did write it down. I believe it's on page 49 of the respondent's opening brief, in footnote 17, that the reference is made to the deposition of Mr. Wake, that question was asked, where the respondents bring up the testimony on page, it's index 50, it's on page 125, although the respondents don't identify also on that page the statement where Mr. Wake says he refrained from engaging or bidding on other contracts. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ward. The appellants will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel, anytime you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Ashley Tronson of Fredrickson and Byron. On behalf of the respondents today, CISO Transportation, LLC, and Collaborative Student Transportation of Minnesota, LLC, whom I'll be referring to as CST for short. I'm going to dive in right on that issue that we left off on the issue relating to whether Mr. Wake refrained from bidding. First and foremost, as we've pointed out in the underlying arguments and record, there is a distinction between bidding and the quotation process, and here the quotation process was used. So just flagging that we take issue with the language of bidding because this was not a bid under Minnesota law. That aside, as counsel pointed out, Mr. Wake was asked in his deposition if he had refrained from opportunities to pursue contracts, direct contracts with Minnesota schools based on this contract. And he initially said yes, and he initially identified some opportunities. But as we pointed out in our opening memo for summary judgment, this is CST's opening memo for summary judgment, which is number 33, docket number 33, footnote 17. If you actually look at the deposition testimony, I go through and I ask each individual instance that Mr. Wakay identified. He identified Osseo, and for Osseo, he said, and this is on deposition page 128, excuse me, which is document number...
I think 30. We can find where it is
in
the record.
Okay, so it's in Mr. Wakay's deposition, page 28, where I ask him why he refrained from pursuing contracts in Osseo. And he said, we had enough work, it was due to COVID too. I went on to ask him about Minneapolis. I said, what about Minneapolis? You mentioned Minneapolis. Was there a request for a quotation process that SafeTree did not participate in because of the non-compete? His answer, I don't know. I walked step by step on each one that he identified, and each one he either said, I don't know, I don't remember, for personal reasons, for COVID, we had enough work. Not a single instance did he identify a circumstance where SafeTree refrained from work based on this alleged, based on this non-solicit. And that bears itself out in the record because obviously he, SafeTree, did pursue opportunities in Robbinsdale, in Centennial, in Brooklyn Park. So again, there was no anti-competitive effect at all with regard to SafeTree. I'm happy to answer any additional questions on that piece. Otherwise, I can dive in on the remaining pieces. So starting from the top, a few things that I wanted to point out. One, there are two different respondents here who brought two different motions for summary judgment, both of which were granted. It is important to recognize and realize that there are two different respondents that are two different legal entities, have two different business services and missions and purposes. This is important for a couple of reasons. One, CST is a Type 3 transportation company. It provides Type 3 transportation, which in a nutshell is basically van services for highly mobile or displaced students. So think homeless students or students who need additional flexibility. It's not a full-on bus. That's the type of services CST provides. CISO Transportation, on the other hand, provides consulting services. It contracts directly with school districts to provide expert consultation relating to transportation matters. That could be bell times, that could be the best routing packages, that could be leasing out its employees to school districts to actually fulfill those job duties and those services. So they offer a full range of suites and it's the whole scope of student transportation. So they're two very different companies who do two different things. CSTMN is a niche, I would say, industry in that it just does Type 3 transportation. That's relevant because, one, some of these claims, plaintiffs are attempting to point to one respondent's conduct in an effort to claim that that is evidence that the other respondent has also allegedly violated the law. Again, they're not the same defendants, and...
To be fair, the evidence does establish that, and I think that this is not reasonably subject to dispute, that these two entities are closely related, that they work together, that there's some evidence in the record that there were communications from Mr. Liebengood in particular to the districts that might suggest that MTN, for example, wasn't doing its job or wasn't able to fulfill routes or at least speculating that it wasn't going to be able to fulfill routes. And then the entities that are going to pick up the pieces are your clients if MTN is canceled. I mean, that seems to be the story that I'm getting when I'm reading the papers. And when I get all that, when I get all of that from what I'm seeing, it does strike me that it's possible that a fact finder could reasonably conclude from that evidence that is presented that there's something there associated with an antitrust violation, something there about a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, or any of the other claims that are asserted here. So why am I wrong? Why is that incorrect?
Yeah, there's a couple of things there that I want to unpack. First and foremost goes to my last point of there are two different companies that do different things. So your comment that, the conspiracy theory is that CISO pushes out contractors so that CST can come in. That's not true, and that really can't happen. So that goes to the fact of CST does the Type 3 services. They can't take over MTN's contract as it relates to yellow buses. I believe in the record somewhere, Stillwater has 8,000 students or something like that. I mean, these are big buses that have to carry a lot of students. CST does not do that. And outside the record, but CST didn't pick up the contract after that. They hired a new yellow bus driver. So, again, it goes to this thought of plaintiffs have this big conspiracy theory that this is what happened, but in reality, it doesn't make sense. Because, number one, the record is clear, CST was in Stillwater before CISO was and before MTN was. And so they're very well established, and they have their own direct contracts with the school districts. They don't need CISO to be giving them work. And number two, even if it happened that way, again, CST, maybe would have covered a couple of Type 3 routes here and there because it was already a contractor in the district, but there's no way it could have taken over the full contract of MTN. So again, it doesn't match with reality of this is why they did it, this is what happened, because that's not how it happens. I hope that explains it a little bit. Just the fact that they offer different services, and there's no way CST could take over these contracts. So it doesn't make sense to say that they are somehow colluding for this to happen, because, one, there's absolutely no evidence to show collusion or any sort of agreement or contract or things of that nature, especially as it relates to restraining trade.
So in the absence of evidence of collusion, the other argument that they make, and I think you spent a good deal of time on in your briefing, is that the communications specifically from Mr. Liebengood to the district identifying what he perceived to be the shortcomings of the performance of the plaintiffs was to intentionally procure the breach of the agreements. And why is it that a reasonable fact finder from this record would not be able to make that determination?
Yeah, two things. One, I just want to clarify, Mr. Liebengood is and was acting as an agent of CISO Transportation. CISO Transportation was the one that was coordinating the Stillwater Transportation Department at that time. So just clarifying, that was not CST, that was CISO Transportation. As it relates to the alleged procurement of a breach, I would disagree that that is what Mr. Liebengood was doing under the contract between Stillwater and CISO Transportation. Stillwater was asking CISO Transportation's advice and expertise on how to run the transportation department and run the day-to-day issues. And so Mr. Liebengood was complying with that contract that it had with Stillwater to provide those facts. So when Stillwater said, what's going on? How many buses have been late? How many drivers haven't showed up? Mr. Liebengood has
provided that. And why isn't that a fact question on element four of the intentional and the interference claim, the without justification? Why doesn't a jury get to decide whether the reason for his behavior isn't a fact question?
Yeah, so I'd say, first of all, there is no evidence in the record calling into question his intent or the reason for it. And number two, under...
couldn't a jury infer from the exchange of emails that occurred what his intent was? In other words, do the email exchanges themselves create a factual issue as to his intent? Because, there could be an inference one way or another about whether he was seeking to interfere or maybe not.
I don't think they do. When read in their context, and also when read in the context of Mr. Liebengood's deposition testimony, which said he was being told by MTN employees that they didn't have enough drivers. That was the intel that they were receiving. So that was the reason that he was asking, I remember taking a step back at this time and
so your response is that if you look at what he said, that negates any inference that could be reached based on the exchanges between MTN and Liebengood.
I would say 3 points. One, yes, in the full context, I don't think there is evidence to show a tortious intent. I don't see that. They haven't put forth evidence to show that, especially evidence based on personal belief, or evidence based on actual belief. Two, when looked at the context and the reasons for it, the record is clear why he was engaging in this conduct. And three, if you go to, you know, recognized exceptions for recognized circumstances for justification under the law, one is providing honest information, and two is acting in the scope of advice when advice is being asked. That's Restatement of Torts, Section 772. And there's a couple of Minnesota cases there that reference this exact point that says, if you hire an expert for their opinion, it's not tortious interference for that expert to provide that opinion as long as they're honestly doing so. So I think this takes it squarely out of the question of whether there is a fact question relating to justification. And then on top of it, I think taking a step back on the breach piece of things, plaintiffs would have to show that there's evidence that MTN was seeking to procure a breach. And again, I don't think that's the case. If you read the actual text of the exchanges, what is happening is Mr. Liebengood is putting forth information so that the district can act accordingly. And based on the other litigation matters, it's clear that the district thought that this was within their contractual rights. So I don't think in any way, shape, or form there was the intent that we're procuring a breach. I think it was more so CISO Transportation was helping the district to enforce its own contractual rights, not breach. And to the extent that there was a breach, it was on MTN, and you know, CISO Transportation had no role in any breaches by MTN. I see I have just over a minute left, so just wanted to see if there were any additional questions from the court that I could address in my time.
It appears not.
Okay. So then lastly, I just wanted to confirm that we are only looking at counts 2, 3, 6, 7, and 13, which means all the other claims are waived. There is no contesting that. All we're looking at is whether there was a breach of an illusory contract, good faith and fair dealing, alleged tortious interference, claims brought by MTN, and alleged antitrust claims. And as it relates to the contract claims, the contract law is pretty straightforward, right? Alleged lack of consideration is a defense. You can't bring a claim for breach of contract for lack of consideration. And the duty of good faith and fair dealing is wrapped into the contract. The contract clearly indicates there are no guaranteed routes, and CST reserves the right to minimize or eliminate altogether routes. And I would point the court to the record where the reason they initially reduced or eliminated the routes was because they found out that SafeTree was violating the contract. So it gave SafeTree multiple instances to rectify that, and they didn't.
Counsel, your time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Ward, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to point out a couple things to the court. First of all, with respect to counsel attempting to impeach Mr. Waque during his deposition, that is something that he could do with the jury. It is up to the jury to determine whether what Mr. Waque subsequently said was false or was a lie or was the truth. It's up to the jury. The court cannot do that. It's the jury that determines credibility. And then with respect to the claim that these are two entities that do very different things, that's true. One of those entities had a hat in every pot or on every head, every entity. So Mr. Liebengood was acting on behalf of Stillwater when he made disparaging and false statements about things that MTN was supposedly doing. One, I'm going to give very quickly one example. There's people who are supposed to be in the office. They are not supposed to be driving buses during a pandemic, by the way. They had bus drivers were falling ill, they were sick. They had bus drivers die at MTN and around the state. So there were people who were sick and who were out. The people who were in the office who had CDL licenses got on the buses and drove children. Mr. Tufar, I believe, drove buses during a pandemic because that's how bad it was, by the way. And all of the school districts were having the same problem. MTN was the only school district that was sued, the only one. The other thing is that, so when Mr. Liebengood, who benefited financially from his relationship, his direct relationship with Stillwater, his direct relationship with CISO acting on behalf of Stillwater, and his relationship with CST when he was wearing that hat as a leased employee of CST, and every employee, with the exception of Mr. LaHaye, worked for CISO. So that money went from Stillwater to CST back to CISO. That's the way it happened. That was a circle. So yes, they did different things, and he had his hat and his hand in every single pot. The emails, again, the court is correct. Those emails show that the parties saw things differently. And by the way, there was not a single complaint about lack of drivers for Type 3 buses. They're vans and small buses. You do not need a CDL license. Any one of us in this room with a driver's license can drive a van or a small bus, and they can pick up people. All of those routes, every single route, including the Type 3 route, belong to MTN under the contract. Now, I don't know how they do this, but defendants in their brief say that, you know, Stillwater sued MTN and brought a TRO because they had the duty to service all these routes, and they didn't. And then they defend against it, so they use it as a sword and a shield. They say, well, CST had a right to be there because they had a contract. They had a contract that had no mandatory terms. There were no routes assigned to CST under that contract. We have that contract. We've seen it. There are no routes. It had no right to routes. The only entity that had a right to routes was MTN. So no, Stillwater couldn't call up CST and say, come pick up our students. Number one, there wasn't a driver shortage with respect to the Type 3 buses, but that is what they were taking because that's how they got money. If MTN serviced those routes, then CST would not have been able to receive those funds. And that's why Mr. Liebengood assigned them to CST, his own company. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The matter is submitted. Thank you very much, counsel, for your arguments today. The matter is submitted. We'll issue an opinion within the statutory time period. And with that, that concludes our calendar, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. All rise. Thank you.